This is a lecture that was given on on November 19th, 1950, by Swami Ashokananda. It is called the Gita, the Universal Gospel. The subject this morning is this, the Gita, the Universal Gospel. I'm using the word gospel in a generally accepted sense of the present time, which is to indicate divine teachings. And probably I'm also using it a little in the old sense, that is, that it is gospel good news. The Bhagavad Gita has gained in popularity with the passing of time, and it can be said that not a year passes in which we do not have a new translation or a new interpretation of the Gita in the English language. Why do you think has this particular text been taken out of the vast content of the scriptural books of the Hindus to be accorded such veneration? There must be very good reason behind such popularity. As far as India is concerned, certainly the Gita has been gaining in greater and greater repute. It has been the other day in an American book, it appeared, that its popularity has been enhanced in India by Mahatma Gandhi's adherence to it. That is only partly true because I know long before the Mahatma appeared on the Indian political scene, the Gita was studied all over India with great application, particularly in certain provinces. As a matter of fact, in the early decades of this century, the influence of the Gita was acknowledged to be behind even the nationalist movement. Even the British government blamed the Gita for supporting the revolutionary ideas of the Indian nationalists. But we need not look to any political doctrine for the popularity of the Gita. Truly speaking, this popularity, one could say, is somewhat puzzling. You see, the Gita is not, first of all, a philosophical text, though to call it merely a book on ethics, as some people have done, is to minimize its philosophical and metaphysical importance. Still, it is not a clear philosophical text. And you would think that modern people, who are so much governed by reason and judgment and the scientific attitude towards everything else, would expect this same rationality demonstrated in the text of the Gita. Although the Gita is rational, there are not many philosophical arguments given to justify its thesis, nor is the book highly organized. I'm quite sure that many of you would arrange all the verses of the Gita on the basis of a better, certainly a more apparent system. There are repetitions, there is overlapping of topics. And yet, as you read this book, it leaves upon your mind an impression which is not only spiritual, but highly satisfying. And it leaves a great sense of harmony in your mind, so that after you have finished studying it, you feel you have studied truth in its universal character. Certainly, you have received enough of the truth to fill the cup of your spiritual longing. And this satisfactoriness, I think, is one of the great secrets of the charm of the Gita. Now here, I think I should tell you something of the historical background of the Bhagavad Gita before my remarks can become intelligible. It is well known that the Gita forms part of the great Sanskrit epic called the Mahabharata. There is a statement that the Mahabharata was once made up of 6 million verses. Just imagine this. But now some parts have been lost and it has been reduced to about 100,000 verses. That has something, is something because of which Hindus have regarded it so highly, and even non-Hindus have been appreciating it more and more as time is passing, particularly in the modern age, as it is being translated into many European languages. It is certainly being much appreciated. I have said that it is part of the Sanskrit epic called the Mahabharata. Some scholars, however, have maintained that the Gita was composed independently of that epic, and then in some ancient past, someone interpolated it. Of course, the majority of scholars do not accept this view. They see no reason why the Gita ought not to have been there from the very beginning. You see, if you read the old Sanskrit books, you very easily get reconciled to their loose plan. They want to inculcate as many stories, they want to include as many stories, all of them, of course, carrying a moral, and as many philosophical discourses as they can. Just as you find some plants in the garden burst into innumerable blooms until the whole tree becomes covered with flowers, any place, any branch in the tree is enough for a flower to burst forth. So these ancient Sanskrit texts used any occasion to burst out into a philosophical discourse or a story of a saint or a sage. You see, these books were not meant to be chronicles of ordinary events. All around us, we have enough ordinary things happening without giving us any kind of real uplift. If something is to be recorded, it should be recorded for a certain ethical or moral purpose. The writers of these books, therefore, always embellish their tales with moral and spiritual discourses, and the Gita must have been one of these. It is enough to say here that there is general agreement that the Gita was an integral part of the Mahabharata and not an interpolation. Now, this particular war that is described was known as the Kurukshetra War. And it took place between two branches of the same royal family, which were known as the Kurus, one part of the Kurus and other part the Pandavas. The Kurus, sons of the blind King Dhritarashtra, were 100 in number, and the Pandavas, there were only 5. These Pandavas were the sons of Dhritarashtra's younger brother Pandu, who himself was blind. Each branch had a separate kingdom, and as the Pandava brothers began to prosper, the Kurus became very envious of them. So they concocted a plan for depriving the Pandavas of their kingdom. They invited them to a game of dice. In those days, just as the Kshatriyas could not refuse any challenge on the battlefield without feeling completely ashamed, neither could they refuse such an invitation. But the dice were loaded. The Kurus had an uncle named Shakuni, which literally means vulture, which is, as it turned out, a very appropriate name. It was he who arranged to have the dice loaded. The Pandavas, who were more or less innocent in such matters, accepted the challenge and underwent repeated defeats. You see, the last bet was that the losers would have to go with their whole family into exile for 12 years and then remain in hiding for 1 year more. If during this year one of them was discovered, they must all again go for 12 years into the forest and 1 year of hiding. And so it would be repeated over and over again. The Pandavas, the sons of Pandu, agreed to this bet, and they lost. They placed their kingdom in the custody of their uncle Dhritarashtra and the 100 cousins, with the understanding, naturally, that after they returned, they would get the kingdom back. Well, they went through these 12 years of forest life. It was not pleasant. However, that part of the Mahabharata called the Vanaparva, or the Book of the Forest, in which that period is described as most beautiful. It contains many incidents and many philosophical discourses, and I sometimes think that it is the most dramatic book in the whole epic. After these 12 years, the Pandavas remained hidden for 1 year successfully. Then they claimed their kingdom, but the Kurus would not return it. There were lengthy arguments between the two parties, and Sri Krishna, who was looked upon as an incarnation of God even in his own lifetime, and certainly as the most powerful personage in contemporary India, most wise, most worthy of respect, Sri Krishna interceded in favor of the Pandavas with the blind king and his 100 sons. They would give up nothing, they said. They would not negotiate. As a matter of fact, they thought of killing the ambassador, Sri Krishna himself, which was an unheard of thing even in those ancient times. Sri Krishna asked at last, give them only 5 villages, 1 for each of the brothers. Let there at least be a token repayment, so that the code of justice will be observed, at least symbolically. But the Kurus refused. So Sri Krishna returned to the Pandavas and said, there must be war, because if you submit to this injustice, thereby injustice will prevail in human society, and the whole texture of life will be torn to pieces. That would be a great sin, and it cannot be allowed. So the Pandavas decided on war, and then both sides sent out invitations to every king and prince of India to come to their aid. All of them ranged themselves on one side or the other, and the two vast armies met on the battlefield of Kurukshetra. That is the setting of the Bhagavad Gita. The very first chapter of the Gita begins with Dhritarashtra's inquiry as follows. What are my sons and my nephews doing right now, who are gathered now on this battlefield of Kurukshetra, which is the field of Dharma, the field of virtue? Oh, Sanjaya, tell me that. Dhritarashtra had not gone to the battlefield, and yet he expressed a sincere desire to know what is taking place between the two armies. It is said that a sage wanted to give him the power to see distant events, but Dhritarashtra, of course, did not want to see the destruction of his kinsmen. So the sage gave this power of vision to Sanjaya, one of the king's courtiers and relatives. Sanjaya sat in the palace near the king and was actually able to tell what was taking place at Kurukshetra, the scene of battle, which was some miles off from the capital. He then said, both sides have now ranged themselves opposite each other and are blowing their trumpets and conches and making all kinds of noise, as warlike people do. And these sounds rend the air with their tumult. Then he saw Sri Krishna driving Arjuna out between the two armies. Now Sri Krishna had offered to be Arjuna's charioteer. He had said, "I shall not bear arms in this war. I have known both sides, and both have asked me to join them, but I shall be your charioteer, O Arjuna." Arjuna was the third of the five Pandava brothers. He was particularly devoted to Sri Krishna. It is said that they had a great similarity of appearance and were in each other's company much of the time. All recognized that they were special friends, and not merely friends, since Sri Krishna was an incarnation of God and the very essence of wisdom and power. Arjuna's friendship for him also carried with it a great sense of reverence. There was no forgetting the fact that Arjuna was a devotee of Sri Krishna. We find in the Gita, Arjuna says, "I have taken refuge in you. I am your disciple. Teach me." There was the relationship of guru and disciple, but also a great friendship between the two of them. When the trumpet sounded, Arjuna said to Sri Krishna, "O friend, drive this chariot between these two armies. I want to look at those who are ranged on the two sides." And when he was driven to the middle of the field and looked at the warriors, he saw many who were his kinsmen on both sides. Suddenly, as you know, a great grief seized him. His body perspired and his mouth became parched, his eyes filled with tears, his body shook, and the weapon fell from his hand. He said, "I won't fight. I do not find it in my heart to kill all these people for whom, actually speaking, we are seeking this kingdom. People want to enjoy the prosperity that comes from the kingdom with their kinsmen and friends. What is this? What is the sense of gaining a kingdom by killing those very people?" Well, so there was Arjuna, just sunk in grief and misery and despair. He not only spoke of his mental condition, but also of the evil of war. And you know, many of us would agree with him. But Sri Krishna, when he saw Arjuna's state of mind, told him that he was behaving like a timid person. He said, "O Arjuna, give up this unmanliness. Stand up and fight. Kutastva kashmalam idam vishame samupastitam." The very words inspire energy and fervor. Where comes this mean faint-heartedness? Now, one of the arguments Arjuna gave for not fighting was an argument which has always impressed the Indian people, and it should impress all people. It was that war brings a degradation of morality. Whenever there is a war, many people are killed, particularly the young. As a result, culture is degraded. Thereby, the whole country suffers. Now that this is one of the consequences of war is well known. Well, evidently Sri Krishna heard Arjuna's arguments, but he gave no direct reply. Probably he thought that all this theoretical justification of not fighting had more of a psychological reason than a metaphysical one. Therefore, he did not bother about the metaphysical reason. But the psychological reason he fought. He saw that Arjuna was plunged in misery and despair. His mind had undergone a sudden change. And Sri Krishna didn't like it. He never treated this sudden type of conversion. He never trusted this sudden type of conversion. So he gave him a special pep talk to start with. "Give up this mean faint-heartedness and arise, O scorcher of your enemies." that I think that was quite the right approach. And Arjuna, the great warrior that he was probably the greatest fighter and general of his time. Arjuna understood that this condition of mind, in which he was suddenly very gentle and sentimental about his kinsmen and others, was not natural with him. And when Sri Krishna told him this, that he was talking learnedly but didn't know what he was talking about, that was, I think, the answer to the philosophical or theoretical reasons that Arjuna had given for not fighting this war. The legitimate question that we should ask here, however, is this. Suppose that war actually took place. Was the Gita itself composed by Sri Krishna? The words that are recorded as coming from the lips of Sri Krishna could not have been a literal report. It is unheard of that in the very beginning of a war, a person just stood in the middle of the opposing armies and gave a discourse which lasted nearly 3 hours. It just could not be. Yes, it is admitted that the book was composed by someone else. The composition is ascribed to a great sage and author of ancient India, whose name was Veda Vyasa, to whom many books are ascribed. It is thought that Veda Vyasa was a generic name, that is to say, it was assumed by various authors, and probably the name of the real author is not known. But whoever he might be, he who composed the Gita must have been an extraordinary person, must have had tremendous philosophical learning as well as spiritual insight. Then a further question here is this. Isn't the author's own teaching which he has foisted upon Sri Krishna, or did the teaching come from Sri Krishna himself? The general opinion is that Sri Krishna must have been responsible for this teaching. And if you ask why, it is because all that has been told about Sri Krishna's life and teachings and doings supports the central teaching of the Bhagavad Gita. So I think it would be quite practical to assume that Sri Krishna must have told Arjuna some of the basic teachings within this short time, in order to inspire him at the beginning of the first battle. And these afterwards became then well known and collected. The comparison may not be very apposite, however. Today you all read the Gettysburg speech of Abraham Lincoln after the Battle of Gettysburg. When it was given, it lasted just a few minutes and did not leave much impression. The speaker himself, Lincoln, was not much satisfied with it. But as it was published and read, it began to assume greater and greater importance. Until today, you think it is almost the mantra of democracy, as if it is a divine pronouncement embodying the very essence of democracy. Sometimes you know such a thing happens. And the Gita originally must have been a discourse of that type. No doubt, in order to develop its theme, many more details were added from Sri Krishna's own teachings, which were not given at this time of the Kurukshetra War. And thus we have the Bhagavad Gita. Now you may ask, why did this Gita begin in such a strange way? You would not like to speak of a spiritual or religious doctrine against the background of war. Of course, one could give the obvious reason and say, well, it happened that way, and what can you do? After all, since the book was written as a part of the Mahabharata, which itself has its central theme, this war between these two houses, how can you avoid that this should happen? It is bound to be there. No, that is not a sufficient reason. You see, the discourse could have been composed omitting this war theme. And today you would be reading the Gita innocently without knowing where from it had been taken, and would never dream it had the background of a war. But war is the background of the teaching of the Gita, and throughout the whole discourse, you find Sri Krishna punctuating his spiritual teachings with the idea of fighting, as if he who composed the Gita did not want us to forget the fact that the background of this teaching is the battlefield. The commentators, the interpreters of the Gita, could not forget it, so they wondered why it had to be so. Some have said that you should take the Gita as an allegory. Certainly a world teacher could not ask us to fight and kill. That could not be a supreme teaching. Certainly the Gita, which teaches so many wonderful things, could not be associated with killing. When Sri Krishna asked Arjuna to stand up and fight, what he meant was an inner fight. This body is Kurukshetra. Some of our faculties and thoughts and emotions are the Kurus, and others are the Pandavas. The Kurus stand for the evil tendencies, worldly tendencies, tendencies toward ignorance. And the good moral and spiritual tendencies are the Pandavas. To begin with, they are of course few in number, but then the Lord is on their side. He guides the general Arjuna, who is the conscience. Between these two sets of tendencies, the fight is to go on until victory has been attained. What is the wonder, therefore, that the composer of the Gita should remind us from time to time of the fact that we must fight? Of course, we are fighting an inner war. Nobody can deny that spiritual seeking is a war, because it is through struggle, great struggle, and through the vanquishing of one side of our so-called nature that we attain to this ultimate victory, which is the realization of God or God vision, or as it is called, illumination, by whatever term you want to call it. So some have said that the Gita should be accepted as really nothing but an allegory. There have been many more commentators who have taken it literally, however, and there are those among them who believe that you can give both interpretations, because after all, everybody knows that you can take everything you experience as a literal fact and also as a symbolical fact. We know that all the facts we experience have many shades of symbolical significance, so they do not see any contradiction between these two interpretations of the Gita. At one time you take it in a literal sense, at another time in a symbolical sense, and thereby you get two meanings, and therefore the two stimuli for your upliftment. But if you want to be very intellectual and definite about it, you will wonder what the writer of this book had in mind. When Sri Krishna is supposed to have asked Arjuna to take up his arms and fight, are we to take it literally for ourselves? It makes a tremendous difference which way we are to take it, particularly in the situation that prevails today. Now, I should say that most of the commentators have said that it is to be taken literally. And if you ask me, how can a philosophical or spiritual teaching begin with such an essential relationship with war? Then my answer to that is, as I shall indicate to you, and as those of you who have read the Gita already know, the Gita was a book meant for all, not just for a handful of people who lived a spiritual kind of life. That life was not the background, that was not the atmosphere of the Gita. And here is one of the reasons why the Gita can be called universal. It was meant for all people. Universality implies that much, that everybody could come to the teaching and get what he wanted. A religion to be universal should be such that everyone, in whatever condition, whatever their spiritual talents or developments are, should be able to come to it and find what they want. They should find not merely what they want now, but as they progress by following that religion, they should find in its teaching help for their future progress. This would be called a universal religion. And you see, when you look for this as one of the elements of the Bhagavad Gita, the very first thing that comes to your mind is that for all of us, or if you want to say so, for the vast majority of us, our spiritual life is a battle. It is a struggle. Each one of us has to be a soldier, first of all. Remember what Christ said, "I do not bring peace, I bring a sword." Christ was a prophet, and he said, "I bring you a sword." Priests will tell you, "Oh, never mind, go to church or bathe in this river and repeat this formula," and then they will promise that after you die, you will go to the place the Lord has kept for you. Tell me, if they were right, why do you find that civilization following in their footsteps is sinking into despair? Why are the people who have followed their instructions not able to prevail against evil? There is something very out of focus here. And Sri Krishna knew this. And why do I say that? Because he had tremendous sympathy for all kinds of people. Tremendous sympathy. Of all, he was the friend. He was that kind of a friend who, taking a person where he is, could put something into him by which that person would become transformed. No word of condemnation anywhere, no word. The Lord is the friend of all. We do not have to fear him. Fear of God is not the beginning of wisdom. And if you want to say so, it is possibly only the very beginning. As long as that fear is there, you cannot proceed very far. So, you may be a good person in the eye of the common person, but in the eye of God, you are still far, far off. He is our eternal beloved. He's the very soul of our soul, the very breath of our breath. Why should we fear God? So, Sri Krishna is the closest to us all. Everybody was Sri Krishna's own, and Sri Krishna was everybody's own. And yet he said to everyone, "You must fight." Just as he told Arjuna, "Partha," that is Arjuna, "do not be a coward." So he is telling each one of us also. And just as from time to time he reminded Arjuna that he must fight, so he is telling us, yes, take up arms, be free from this fever and fight. You know, when we become timid and begin to feel nervous, we have a fever in our mind and body. And he said, be free from this fever and fight. This is just the beginning. Nevertheless, to set this choice for one and all, the Gita had to give that kind of example. Take the teachings of other teachers. They will tell you, give up all these things. This life is all unreal. Of course, this is unreal. This would not last long. Everybody knows it. But most people will say, I cannot give up everything. I'm held here. I'm in the world. I have relatives and I have duties and to do for them. I further think that I'm responsible for my neighbors. I think of my own country. I think of humanity. I just cannot give up my infinite number of duties without feeling like a coward, a deserter. I cannot do it. Sri Krishna is not asking us to do it. He says, do your obligatory work. It is better to work than not to work. That was Sri Krishna's teaching. And you see, here comes the element of universality, because it applies, as I said, to almost all of us. Sri Krishna said further, by implication, that even if you give up the world and become a monk, as so many religions have taught, you still have to act. Christianity was the religion of monks and not of common people to begin with. Read Christ's teachings. By following them, you could not live in the world, you could not have families, you could not have sons and daughters, you could not earn a living. Whatever you want, whatever you get, you are to give it to the poor. You could not bring it to your family. Where did Christ say that you are to save for tomorrow? No, that was a religion. His was a religion for monks in the beginning. Buddha's teaching was the religion for monks. To Hinduism too, we have teachings that were essentially meant for those who recognize that this world is nothing, and therefore to serve it, to do anything for it, is useless. The only thing is to put it aside, leave it behind. Christ said, let the dead bury their dead, do thou follow me. This is dead. Let those who want to remain dead take care of the dead, you follow me. Many religions and many teachers have talked like that, but Sri Krishna did not. And so there again is an appeal, you see. Now then we come to the teachings that he gave to Arjuna, who at once becomes a representative of the average person. He is no longer just the third of the Pandava brothers, the commander-in-chief who had to be activated to fight this war, but Arjuna becomes a representative, our representative, no matter in what stage we are. I may be a very low person, you may be a very advanced person. Each of us will find in Arjuna his own representative, receiving teachings from Sri Krishna which will help him. I, who am in a low stage of development, shall find what I want, more than what I want, for the present time and for the future. You, who are highly advanced, will also find what you want. As Sri Krishna speaks to Arjuna, we also, listening through the ears of Arjuna, will hear the very teachings we need. When we come to the actual teaching of Sri Krishna, we have already entered into the second chapter of the Gita. Every chapter of the 18 that compose this book is called a yoga, and the second is called Sankhya Yoga. Second chapter is called Sankhya Yoga. What is Sankhya? Sankhya is the name of a certain philosophical system in India. And so some people have been confused, thinking Sri Krishna was teaching that philosophy here. But in the Gita, the word Sankhya means knowledge, jnana. And Sri Krishna is beginning his teaching by laying down the fundamental principles of jnana yoga. You are told what you really are, that you are divine in nature and nothing can taint you. This is Sankhya Yoga, the path of jnana. Then, having established the nature of the self, Sri Krishna lays down the path of Karma Yoga, duty for duty's sake, with no desire to enjoy the results. You have the right to action only, not to the fruits thereof, he tells Arjuna. In the first chapter, Sri Krishna has presented the most serious circumstance in which one would have to perform one's duty. If this book was to help everyone to grow and to find spiritual knowledge, he had to take it up in the most extreme and difficult case imaginable. Then in the second chapter, he shows how duty is to be performed as karma yoga. Sri Krishna's advice here to all is that once it is clear to you what your duty is, however terrible its effect must be, do it with detachment. For Arjuna, duty meant the very destruction of the foundation of Indian life by killing almost all of the warriors at Kurukshetra. So I feel, and I am fully convinced that it's Swami Ashokananda speaking, so I feel and I'm fully convinced, at least from the practical point of view, that even if a person is an ethical person, a very considerate person, he will often be placed in a position where he will find that the action he must do is not absolutely ethical, absolutely innocent. He should try to make it innocent, but still he will find, as Sri Krishna said plainly, there cannot be any fire without some smoke. Therefore, there cannot be any action altogether good without a particle of evil in it. So first of all, you see your duty in relation to your position. Here you will ask, now admitting that some duties have evil in them, I'm still faced with a moral question, that if I do evil, an evil deed, my mind will be contaminated by it. Then how about my spiritual life? That is where the very essence of the path of karma yoga comes. And what did Sri Krishna say? Through the study of the mind of man, he found the way to be untouched by any action, and it required very deep insight. He himself pointed out that the process of action, the ramification, the results of action, is complex and deep. When you do something, how far it goes and what effect it has on your being, on your mind, on your psyche, you do not know. There are deep complications. It is just like a tree that you have planted. On the surface, you can't see what a ramification of roots there has been, but Sri Krishna found this fact. When a person seeks the fruit of his action only for himself, then even a good deed becomes binding. And if he does not seek the fruit of action for himself, if there is some evil in the action he was doing, he will still remain untouched by it. That is the secret of karma yoga, and that is a most profound secret. Although we find traces of this teaching in some of the Upanishads, for the first time in world history, Sri Krishna was the one who told mankind the secret of action, and thereby transformed man's life altogether. A soldier fighting on the battlefield is in a righteous cause, if he followed the teaching of Sri Krishna, would then not be fighting. He would be actually practicing spirituality. The banker counting his money in his bank and realizing his profit would still be practicing religion, spirituality, if he did not cover the fruit of his action for himself. When you do things in this spirit without craving any result, you at once become illumined. We have to learn to do it. The Lord Sri Krishna knew that all would not become impassioned in the pursuit of truth. He was the gracious Lord, and so he proposed different steps. He said, after you have done anything, offer the results to me. Offer your action to the Lord. You may have forgotten in the course of doing these actions that you are really not craving for the results. All right, start this way. Don't keep anything for yourself. Offer your work and yourself to the Lord. Afterwards, you will find the Lord himself is working through you. Afterwards, you will find nothing arises from you yourself. The source of things is much, much deeper than this I of yours. This I is a superficial thing. Everybody knows it. Even the egotistical person knows it. This I, this ego, is nothing. It is a humbug. The real self, which I am, is much, much deeper. That self is actually one with God. And you find everything arises from that depth. You see, when you become established a little bit in this karma yoga, you'll find everything arises from there. Now, even if you practice even the thousandth part of this great teaching, just consider what will be the status of the community. You will not all have to run into the forest to become hermits, no. You will go on doing the same things you are doing, but there will not be any confusion about it. Then just consider what your life will be like. You will be just like flaming spirit. You will not be a coward. He who practices the teaching of Sri Krishna is never a coward. He's a spirited person, and that is what we shall be if we practice this karma yoga. This lecture was given by Swami Ashokananda on November 19th, 1950.